Okay, this is the seventh in our series, Poetics and Politics, an event organized by the Department of English and the American Indian Studies Program and sponsored by a number of people, including the University Library, the Intertribal Graduate Council, the Center for Creative Photography, and others. As most of you know, we'll be moving weeks from tonight. We were scheduled to be here to hear James Welsh in this space. 2 weeks from tonight, we'll be in the Arizona Ballroom in the Student Union. We'll also change the time from 7 to 7:30 so that those of you who forget and come here have time to walk over and still catch the reading. So try to mark that down. We have a little flyer out in the lobby that has the information on it. Pick one up if you're like me and need something written down to remind you. So 2 weeks from tonight, James Welsh, Arizona Ballroom, Student Union, and then from that point on, each week we'll be in the Arizona Ballroom with one exception. That's on April 12th when Nora Naranjo Morse will be here. We'll be back here in the Center for Creative Photography Auditorium. That's the only exception from now on. I ordered 600 chairs in the Arizona, so we should have plenty of room. And this is the flip side of the organizer's concern, huh? What happens if you have 600 chairs and 300 people? So those of you who've been telling friends to stay home, you might invite them to come along in 2 weeks. I'd like to fill those chairs up. Okay, I have a couple of announcements that I think will interest you. One is an announcement from an organization called Arts Reach. Arts Reach sponsors workshops with Native American students throughout Arizona and beyond. Wednesday, March 18th at 7 p.m., they'll be sponsoring a reading of fiction and poetry written by Native American students who have participated in their workshops. This reading will be held in the Arizona State Museum, which is here on campus, right at the entrance, the west entrance to campus. That's 7 p.m. Wednesday, March 18th. We still have, remarkably, we still have some of our brochures left, and if any of you would like to have one, please pick one up on the way out. Since this is going to be our last evening at the center for a while, I wanted to recognize a couple of people who've made things easier for us here. One person is Tim Troy. I don't know where Tim is at the moment. He's usually behind the desk out there. Tim Troy has been our contact here and has gone to great lengths to make all of us comfortable. Thank you, Tim. Also, Dustin Levitt has helped him out. Okay, it's my pleasure to introduce tonight's reader, Greg Saras. Greg comes to us from UCLA, where he teaches in the American Studies program and in the Department of English. He received a PhD from Stanford University and has written extensively in the last few years. Among his publications are a book, Keeping Slug Woman Alive, which the University of California Press will be releasing next year. A short story published in the anthology Talking Leaves titled How I Got to Be Queen, which will be turned into a movie by the American Playhouse Theater this year. It's in production now. He's also completing a project in which he's collecting writing by various contemporary California Indian writers, a project that I think he'll have completed certainly within the next 6 months. He's been a busy man. Somehow he's also managed during this time to write fiction, and it's in that connection that we welcome him as our reader. So, Greg Saras.
I've been incredibly busy, as Larry said, but it's always great, and I will continue to come back to Tucson. Something spectacular happens every time I'm here. The first time I was here, you had record 119 degree heat. That was a couple summers ago. And as I was coming from the airport yesterday, we were going through rivers of water. So Tucson is always a surprise. And what's always wonderful, what's not a surprise, is the audiences are always, always wonderful. So it's good to be back. I don't know that Larry mentioned, my tribal background is Pomo, Cushaya Pomo, and Coastal Miwok from California, up above, and all that wine country and wealthy hot tub country around Marin County. So the Miwoks were trying to get federal recognition. I'm enrolled at Cushomo, but I'm also Coastal Miwok, and we're trying to get federal recognition and take back some of Marin County. we'll see. That's been another one of my projects. So tonight, what I'll do is I'll read a story and then I'll be glad to talk. I know people haven't entertained or had questions before, but it's a little different. I worry that I might bore you because people will read a poem and then you get a breather and then so on and so forth. But I'll read a story. People usually want me to read the story that American Playhouse is turning into a movie, but I'll let you see the movie. We're going to shoot this summer on location in Santa Rosa, which will be nice. That'll get me out. And I think it's so important. I'm happy, as I told the class earlier, that it's about, it's in the stories in Talking Leaves, and it's about a young American Indian girl whose family is having a lot of many problems, and it's about what she does to hold the family together. And it's so good that finally, on film, before everybody, we'll get to see people who happen to be Indians rather than Indians who happen to be people. I think too often, like in Dances with Wolves and all these kinds of things, Indians are in the background. It's not really about us. We're a backdrop, whether we're seen in a negative light or a positive light. This is about us. We're the central characters, except for a visit or two by a welfare worker who's white. It's all Indian. And I think this is the kind of direction I'd like to see things going, where their stories are told from our perspective. Luckily, I not only wrote the screenplay, but I'll get to co-produce and assistant direct the movie, which is I'm very happy about. Well, I know that story's always a winner, but I wanted to try something else. This film thing is going wild. I'm going to meet with Sundance people, Redford and these other people, a week from tomorrow, and they're considering a couple other stories. So I thought I'd try one of them out on you. I was thinking of this story and then how I got to be queen, and I was wondering which story to read. And I was at a friend's the other night having dinner, and there was an old Mae West movie on, and she said, whenever I'm caught between two evils, I always pick the one I haven't tried. So I thought, okay, well, that's a sign. I thought that's a sign. I'll pick the story I haven't read before. So it's quite different from how I got to be queen. This one is just came out in Fiction International, a special edition on American Indian literature. And the title is Waiting for the Green Frog. And I'll go with this story and then... By the way, most of my story, these stories are part of a collection of short stories I'm working on. And there's 10 or 12 stories. I have six of them completed now. And they all take place in one part or an area of Santa Rosa, and all the people related somehow, if not by blood, then by historical circumstance. And this is an older woman. This is one of the older grandmothers speaking. I am an old woman now, just about like any other, except for what I am going to tell you. You want to know about me, don't you? Okay, then. It's no secret what I am. When my son was a young man, when he thought of nothing but what he could do with that thing he thinks makes him a man, I pulled a tiny rabbit with the tail of a crow from the center of his chest. I used my flint piece. I cut him open, the same way the white doctors use a knife. Call it surgery. I caught that rabbit by the ears, between my thumbs, and pulled up. The entire room of people heard it squealing for its life, which I would end. And Alfred, my husband, when he was giving his hot-picking money to the Catholics in Santa Rosa and everything else to old Lady Hatcher, I danced 16 nights and sang every song I knew and some I didn't so that he would live. A part of me wanted him to die, given what he put me through, though, I admit. But that's the part I put aside for this business. my medicine is good. I danced and sang until that jealous old spook Sam Toms quit, until his curse, which came each night in the form of a great blue light, faded into nothing outside our back door. I won those fights. I won all my fights, which is why I am still sitting here today, why I am talking. I say fight, but it might make more sense if I say game. It is like gambling, a crapshoot. Every time I stand to sing doctoring songs, when these hands locate the pain in a person's body, the game is on. I gamble with my life. It's not like in the white man books you read about us Indians. It's not me. I do not have the power. These hands and the songs are power. They are what I use in the game, my weapons against the odds. I must outwit my opponent. If something goes wrong, if the disease gets the upper hand, it would finish me, leave me a mull hag with death my only prospect. So I use the songs. The words charm. They put the disease in the patient's body to sleep, make the disease forgetful. Then the hands move like pieces of metal to a magnet. Okay, so how do the hands get this way? With my basket. That old basket shaped like a canoe with a butterfly design. I make baskets, but I didn't make that one. It was given to me by that old man, my mother's uncle, when I was sick. I didn't want to do this work. I wanted to chase the boys and drink wine at the train station. I wanted to do just as the others did. So I went down. Call it coma. Darkness. Felt like I was in a tunnel. I heard this voice. You don't see what I am telling you. You are going to spend your life on earth like this, throwing your life away. That was the spirit talking. Then I realized I wasn't in a tunnel at all. I had been underwater. When I came to, I was holding on the side of a canoe, my head just above water, and then I saw that old man. He was singing and leading me around the front room with my hands fastened to the basket. This is what you are going to use, he said. Your hands will have this basket power to pull up sickness from people. Later, my mother told me the basket had been his. He died not long later. After that, he told me. He told me he wanted me to have it. At that time, when he was doctoring me, I didn't know much. I just knew he was singing and talking and tugging on the basket, pulling me round the room. It turned out true, everything he said, that old man. And that gets me back to the other part of this business, which is the songs. It started with songs. You have to sing those songs, old uncle said. Sick people will come. One day a song hit me, just as if someone hit me with a stick on the side of my neck, and the pain spread until it was singing in my throat. That was my first song. Then another and another. It went like that for many years. I never knew when I would get hit. My mother said I was becoming with power. Several people prayed for me, that coast woman, then Lily Rosario, and that north man. All of them danced and sang. Each one gave advice. But like I said, I didn't want this life. It was something after old uncle gave me the basket, some time later, that I heard singing out by the shed. That was on the land, old land, over by Sebastopol, near the lagoon. The others had gone to town, over to Santa Rosa, because in those days we couldn't get supplies in Sebastopol. Maybe everyone was working in Santa Rosa, I don't know. I was alone doing the laundry, which is how I took time off from work in the fields and orchards. I was folding shirts and things in the kitchen. We had a big table there, and I heard this singing. I thought I was hit with song again, but I felt no pain, no whack on the neck. And the singing wasn't in me. It was a man's voice. Just as if someone was under the window. I looked out. I could see the shed, and as far as the tules that lined the lagoon, nothing, no one. Couple of chickens the raccoons hadn't caught, and my stepfather's pig. Then I thought of someone trying to spook me. I figured a person was behind the shed, where I couldn't see. I was foolish in those days. I grabbed a butcher knife, thinking that could stop a spook. The shed sat hardly 100 feet from the house, and I went out without stopping, butcher knife in my hand, clear around back of that place. Then I went inside. I checked behind the broken carriage, looked in the dark corners where we kept the tools and feed. I cussed, but the singing didn't stop. Show yourself, I kept calling. With just a big voice, show your little self. One thing, I didn't go down to the Tules where someone could have been hiding, watching me. The voice was right there in the yard. It was everywhere around me, pounding the way songs did in my throat. Only now the songs pounded against my body, like squeezing me from head to toe. The only thing that was free was my throat, and I hollered things that must have shook St. Rose Church 10 miles away. By this time, I was sitting on the bench under the kitchen window, where my stepfather hitched the horses. I knew something out of the ordinary was happening. I didn't know I was struggling, for the last time, with that which would change me forever. By nightfall, I would have a new life. In 4 days, I would have my first patient. With the knife across my lap, I sat facing the shed. Something told me the voice was coming from there. I don't know. Maybe I was telling myself that. I was telling myself this and that, whatever came to my mind. I set my eyes on anything that moved. It was 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, a late autumn day, and the sun caught on shiny things, stones, the door latch, in the chicken's eyes. And I guess that's how I first noticed the frogs, shiny-backed little things hopping in front of the shed, coming from round the corner, circling the building counterclockwise. Frogs up from the lagoon, I thought. We had frogs in the yard all the time. Sometimes a pig ate them. Just then I looked for the pig. Nothing. No pig, no chickens. The place was empty. And when I looked, the stones were dull gray, the door latch the color of lead. Only the frogs. More of them coming and going the same way. And they stopped in a certain place each time before they moved on, right in front of me. At first I thought the little green things with black glinting eyes were cute. They were something to think about while the songs that pounded the buildings and everything in sight squeezed me tighter and tighter. Then the yard emptied. No yard, no shed, not even the sky. Only the pounding like a hammer knocking away whatever I knew, all that I could see except for those frogs. Then I realized something. It was only one frog, the same frog going around and around the shed, and each time it came from the corner it was bigger. I had no sense of time, how long since I had first seen the little green thing. When I looked again, it was the size of a dog, large as my stepfather's pig. I wasn't myself. Do something, I said to this frog. Stop this or I'm going to die. It winked at me. You know some words there, lady, it said. What a cusser. Just like that, a voice. I wanted to answer, but I couldn't because my voice was singing, and I was on my feet dancing in place with my whole life in front of me. I had no breath. I was beaten as if I were the song, and the songs in me inseparable. Of course, those songs I heard and was now singing were the power songs, the ones that had been making a home in my throat all along. And there was a chorus, backup singers, my helpers, all those women and men who would stand behind me singing these songs as I wrestled with disease. I saw all of them from the beginning to end, my cousins, Philomena Jones, even Sam Tom's sister. They were singing, keeping time with the red clappers, and that frog was talking to me and showing me the instruments I would use for curing the sick. Old Uncle's bath, the flint piece, a tobacco pipe from the mail order catalog, and the cocoon rattle. Only the frog wasn't there anymore, just the voice. And it said in 4 days my cousin from Tamales would come. She was full of little black minnow fish. I was given a song to net them. Then I heard my mother and stepfather fighting. You have overworked my daughter, and now she has taken her life, my mother said. My mother was the excitable type. Her husband was not. Lucy, go jump in the water. Look, the knife, the end of her. There's no blood. Turn her over. Check her back. I opened my eyes just as my mother started to turn me. I was sprawled in the yard in front of the shed. My mother was crying, her face full of water, and my stepfather was behind her holding the lantern. Beyond, there was a sky bright with stars. The next day, the next afternoon, I wove a net of fine willow branches, just as I was instructed. I can only collect willow at certain times. Other times I do this or that. I fast. Whatever I am told. My stepfather believed at first, but after my cousin appeared, as I said she would, after I calmed and healed her wreathing body, he never doubted again. Who would doubt a catch of black fish? So wherever I go, I have a shed. I call it the frog's house, where that frog can hop round and round like the first time. When we moved to the Indian land here in Grayton, my stepfather built a place 100 feet behind the new house. I worried that because we weren't near the lagoon, I might have left the frog behind. 2 weeks went by, then sure enough, It came around the corner, sounding the whole place with songs. That time I had a patient coming from Lake County, a young man poisoned by his in-laws. And when I married Alfred, he knew my conditions. Use the shed for tools, I said. But I know now that I needn't have said anything. Even with his riding to take communion at St. Rose's every Sunday, he never questioned me. That's how I know, in looking back, that in spite of that church and Hatcher and everything else, he loved me to the day he died. He never doubted me. Only now folks say this is hooey. Like my granddaughter Darlene, for instance. She says she wants to make baskets. Teach me, Grandma, she says. I say with me there are rules about weaving, collecting the sedge and bulrush. Okay, then. I go, even though I know she hasn't listened to a word I said. One part of me says I need help digging the sedge roots. That's the part of me that's old. And look what happens. She picks me up. It's 12 noon, and she's got both kids with her. Come on, Grandma. Sorry I'm late. Jenny's sick. Had to pick her up at child care. Then I had to fill out papers for the damn social service woman. I am eating a piece of bread and the leftover soup her mother dropped off. Because of my sugar, I can't go that long without eating. Little Jenny peeks at me over the top of the table. She's sniffling, snot coming out her nose. The other one, the little boy, hides behind Darlene trying to make sense of the four-legged aluminum contraption next to me, which is my constant companion these days. Darlene drops her keys on the table as if evidence that she is here. I see on the key ring plate with the words, love me or leave me. Are you on your period, I ask. No, Grandma, you told me the rules. I said I'm sorry I'm late. When my nose was good, when I still possessed the fine-tuned senses of a wild animal, I could tell if a woman was menstruating. What difference does it make, I think. I hold her 8 o'clock. I told her 8 o'clock, the latest, and no kids. I told her about fasting and about it, the time it takes me to pray over the place I'm going to dig sedge, not to mention the time it takes us to drive there and me to shuffle from the road to the creek bed. Already enough rules are broken. But like I said, I need help. We stop for gas, and the man shortchanges Darlene. It was a mistake, but before she is half finished telling him off what happened, he hands her the money. When she gets back in the car, she slams the door and mumbles something mean about the man so he can hear her. I see the shadow on this side of the garage, of the station garage. It's past 1 o'clock. Is something wrong, Grandma? She asks. She hands me the change from the gas. I keep it by something for the kids. By now, I know we won't dig a single root. I just wonder what will happen. Along Highway 12, on the way to Santa Rosa, I see the buildup, the housing tracts and apartments. Only one dairy is left, and here and there along the streets and in the front yards of the houses that look the same, a pear or apple tree from the old orchards. When I was little, I helped my mother and aunts pick acorns under huge oak trees. Used to be dirt road here. I jump, hearing myself out loud, then say something to sound deliberate. This road was just dirt road. See, Grandma, I got to get all that down your life. The teacher at the junior college was going to help me. Then I had to quit school. I got mouths to feed, Grandma. You got to understand that. Little Jenny leans on me, sleeping. The boy between Jenny and Darlene is quiet now, too. I have a hard time pronouncing his name. That Mexican name Darlene says too fast. Out of Santa Rosa, we go north. But, Grandma, it doesn't matter. I can still write the book. What, I ask? It's been some time since it said anything. I can't think what it is or what book she's talking about. My mind wanders. Then I figure about the book, since Darlene the last couple months has been talking about recording me. I don't need that teacher to help me, Darlene says. Anyway, he's white, Grandma. Those guys just want to get their names on a book. They don't really know nothing about us. I tell her where to turn off the highway. We follow the road along the creek. I see the earth is damp, good for digging. I forget myself. I don't want to listen or pay attention to Darlene. I don't even hear little Jenny struggling to breathe through that snot in her nose. Anyway, Grandma, I got someone else to help me, and this is what this whole conversation is leading to, Grandma. I got something very important to tell you. She pauses to make sure I am listening and know the importance of what comes next. She's like my mother that way, her great-grandmother. If Darlene didn't have her hands on the wheel, she would be wringing them in her lap. I have someone special in my life, Grandma. I didn't want to say until I was sure. You know, I haven't had the best luck in men department. This guy is different. You'll be happy. Guess what? He's Indian. Sioux Indian, all the way from South Dakota. I met him at Indian Health. He's interested in Indian things, isn't he? I say. Yeah, see, I told him how you are, how you know things. I told him how we're Pomo Indians right from this area. And you know what he said? There's no such thing as Pomo or Sioux. That's just a name the white man gave us. See, the same thing you always say, Grandma. Okay, I said, we are Tule Lagoon people. And that's why he said us Indians have to write our own books. White man doesn't know anything and thinks we're dumb. You see it all the time, like that man back there at the gas station. Darlene is still on the white man kick when we cross to the cattle guard under McGill's property. I don't know. She's talking a mile a minute. I tell her to stop at McGill's house to let someone know we are here. Half a dozen times I try to interrupt her. She stops only where the road ends, which, as it turns out, is where we got out and start the walk to the creek. Like I said, it's no easy chore for me, that walk. So I let Darlene fuss with the kids and pack the trowels and small pickass while I... My four aluminum legs in front of me, my dress dragging behind, must be a sight. But I'm not thinking of myself. I'm smelling the damp, warm air and seeing how the sun hits things this time of day, the oaks, the willows near the water. That's when I stop to rest and look up from the cow stuff I must dodge in my path. I get to the sedge beds below the willows. I forget what I know and start praying anyway. The creek reflects quivering sunlight on the willows, and I see what I am being told. I see in the flickering light the motion of the diamondback's rattle. I look quickly for Darlene and the kids. Don't go near the water, I holler. Come back. But I don't plead anymore. I am singing the power songs for safety with all I have. I am lost in song, and that's why what happens next isn't at all clear. I hear a loud whir like thunder behind me. The dogs bark, and Darlene is running up from the creek, the boy in her arms, little Jenny just behind. Then the world turns clear around, and the next thing I know, I am looking straight up at McGill. Behind him is the sun, and it's calm on his black western hat. Mrs. Copaz, are you okay? I'm sorry. Caroline, it's me, Charles McGill. Darlene is screaming for him not to touch me. Caroline, it's me, he says. Are you hurt? He looks old as me, poor thing. Pockmarked beak nose and white whiskers. I wonder how he's going to get himself up off his knees. My aluminum walker, which I am under, I suppose. When I can think where I am and what's happened, I'm embarrassed. Darlene gets me to my feet. I hold the walker for McGill to pull himself up with, even though he shows me he doesn't need it. Darlene has called him every name she can think of. I think lucky she's lost the pickaxe or she'd have threatened him with it. He displays the kindness to ignore her and offers me a ride back to the car. Of course, Darlene objects. No way to treat the man who has kept this track of land over 50 years for me, I'm thinking, as he makes his way back to the jeep and barking dogs. Hush up, bastards, he says. I start back to the car. He ruined our whole day, Darlene says, with the kids yapping on both sides. He saved your life, I think to myself. Something terrible would have happened. What, I don't know, but I saw it coming. In Santa Rosa, we stop at Indian Health to pick up my medicine, which was part of the plan. I let Darlene go in and sit with the kids. I think back on what happened. Someone once showed me pictures of cave drawings Indians did of people with lines around their bodies. It's like that. I don't know those Indians, where those drawings are from, but it's like that. I have four lines around me, spirit lines, protection, so nothing will get into me. Ha, out there in McGill's pasture, those lines held me up like a dummy. They are stretched, worn like old tendons. I turn to wipe little Jenny's nose, and when I look up, who do you think is coming out the building? This tops off the day. It's old Lady Hatcher, fat and on her cane, breasts that half the county enjoyed, now hanging like the udder of a 10-year-old cow. Hands that cast half the spells I fought, now crooked with arthritis. I straighten in my seat, throw my shoulders back, hold my head as if I were again. This all after I'd just fallen in a cow field like a wild mallard shot out of the sky, just in case Hatcher should see me. I'm still here, Hatcher. Remember our meeting just 2 weeks ago? And that's what I'm getting back to. That's the story, what just happened. You see, we go way back, me and Mary Hatcher, like two different flowers in the same field. We come out each spring, show our colors in the summer, cast seeds in autumn, then sprout with the first good rain and find where the other has taken hold for another round. Love and jealousy tangle with business. Throw hate in there, too. Our battles over the years cover the length and width of all that which is human. She is a poisoner, and she stole my husband. I hate her when I think of it. I am jealous, I admit. After all, I am human. For nearly 10 years, my husband was charmed by that woman, taken in by her love songs and made crazy by everything she had under those fancy city clothes she wore. She was high-flutin' looking, nothing like what you see today, just another old in with that light skin and long wavy hair parted on the side. She looked as if she was Spanish or a pretty Mexican. Of course, the stories told about her today are true. She operated a house. She hired the girls and took money from the men. I believe she sat in her parlor in that place on West 7th and drummed up business with song. I see her sitting among her fine things, lamps and cherrywood furniture, in her store-bought dress, with crystal charmstones in her cupped hands, or maybe on the second-story balcony, casting powder from the dried remains of an orange-bellied salamander into the moonlit air. I can't prove any of it. She did coerce every man within her reach, white and Indian, one way or the other. My husband was special to her, and it pains me to say this. He cared enough to give her 2 children and never to forget them. Yes, Alfred Kopasz, my husband, is the father of Mary Hatcher's 2 children, her only 2 children, and the whole county knows it. Each Sunday, Alfred drove into Santa Rosa, and after he had communed up the walkways for the priest, he took the 2 kids out for the day, dinner, clothes, what have you. This went long after him and Hatcher called it quits, until those kids were growing. What was I to tell 9 needy faces each Sunday? Your father is working. Hatcher sacrificed the boy some years back when her attempt to poison someone backfired. The girl is alive and well with children of her own. Who do you think was helping Hatcher out of Indian Health the other day? You see, it's rubbed in my face all the time, so I should hate morning, noon, and night, and then some. But I cannot carry on my life that way. That's the difference between me and Hatcher. With her, it doesn't matter. Poison is the handmaid of hate. It works where we are weak. It plays on the sourness in our hearts. If Hatcher hates me, if she is jealous and greedy, all the better for her. Her life depends on it. Indian people know about poison. It has been with us from the beginning of things. Poisoners know how to use the disease and pain, and they know where. In the old days, a poisoned man or woman lived separate from the camp, where at camp and they could see and watch. Poisoners watched enemies. Nowadays, you can't tell so easy. The way we live, a poisoned person could be next door in your own house. And what a field day for that person. For we are so full of hate and ignorance these days, we can't see 2 feet in front of us. Hatcher was a perfect candidate. She comes from 2 different tribes somewhere up north, I forgot now. But the story goes that her mother died, and that she was raised by her father's people who hated her mother's people. She was passed back and forth. You know how old Indians are. They suspect what's in the blood. So by the time this girl was 5 years old, her heart was weak enough that anyone listening could hear it crying, and no one listens better than a poisoner. And that's what must have happened, because old Salvador King took her as a child. She would be his last pupil, his 4th leg. Salvador King was so full of poison he needed 4 people to carry it for him. 4 legs. His daughter, Sam Toms, who lives by the fairgrounds in Santa Rosa, the half-breed or whatever he was with blue eyes who sat in the park, and Mary Hatcher. Of course, Hatcher is the only one still living. They say she sleeps with King's pipe. Sam Toms was the one who introduced me to Hatcher. Oh, I had met her before, her and Sam Toms and the rest of them, in the songs, charmstones, insects, animals, whenever else I found in patients' bodies. Poison was nothing new to me by this point. I can tell my patients what's happened to them. The voice tells me where the frog comes. But I never set eyes on Mary Hatcher until just before Sam Toms tried to kill my husband, just before I sang and danced the blue light into nothing. In fact, I would have figured someone, Sam Toms, whoever, was after me because of my medicine and got my husband. I would have been wrong. I can see what's happened to my patients, but I can't always say why. Hardly a week before that incident with my husband, I found out the truth, simple as seeing a stop sign on the road. Far as I'm concerned, it's the only true, honest thing Sam Toms ever did. I thought he poisoned me. I was shopping at the market in Santa Rosa. We had a car by this time, and I was one of the first to drive. So I was alone, only a couple kids with me, the smaller ones, not like in the old days when everyone jumped on the wagon. I was bent over in the market, pulling a sack of flour from the pallet on the floor, when I felt a tug on my coat. It was the rainy season, and I wore a heavy overcoat. I thought it was one of the kids, but just as I looked up, I found both of them in front of me and caught from the corner of my eye a dark hand. Sam Toms, same as always, winter or summer, in that button-up suit and Stetson hat, with only his black face showing. "Excuse me," he said. "Excuse me, nothing. I got my groceries and the kids and drove straight home. I could hardly grip the wheel. I went to my shed, sat there in front of it and prayed, but nothing came. No protection songs. When it became dark, I gave up. Maybe I should call someone good to pray for me, I thought. Then, when I was inside sorting the groceries, which had been sitting for hours, up from my coat pocket floats the note. At first, I thought it was my grocery receipt, but I saw the scrawl. It spelled it out direct in the affair and the time and place. I looked at the clock. My mind was upside down, my life inside out. I warmed leftover beans and put the oldest kid in charge. The rest you can guess. I drove back to Santa Rosa and found the place on West 7th. But oh, it was pitiful. My husband's horse is an old outdated wagon parked along the shiny new cars. What testimony. Pitiful and so beautiful and true, I felt as if my heart dropped on the car seat and was beating for anyone to see in the pale street light. There was nothing I could do to retrieve it. Later, notions about other women in that place dissolved into thin air. No matter what excuse I made, no matter what other story I put together to cover my eyes, Hatcher and Alfred broke through and stood together for me to see bright as day. It was just as Sam Toms said, jealous Sam Toms who told the truth only because he was a fool for Hatcher, too. That night, I drove home not knowing my own name. What I was thinking about, I don't know. I don't remember. I got home. I know that much because I can say I didn't go to into. I didn't see my children. I was seated in front of that shed, caught up in the songs, hearing that voice, the frog, something about a girl from the coast who would come the next day with her grandmother. I had to go through with it. I had to go on with my own life, leave my behind my hurt, my hate. Like I said, I saved my husband from Sam Toms after this, but when I think about it, I get happy that my life has destroyed so much of her work. In those days, I was busy. It wasn't just Sam Toms and Hatcher and King's daughter and that man in the park. Old man McGill was living in these parts and going strong, and there were others. People come to me from all over then, 7 days a week, sometimes half the tribe. I doctored back to back, 20 people at a time. My yard overflowed with the sick. For certain kinds of poison, I must build a fire to burn the poison as it sits in my hands. Once I held my hands in the flames for one whole night. My son kept asking, "Mama, when are you going to get up?" I suppose he was tired of bringing wood, but he knew, just as my other children knew, this work was our bread and butter. I was paid well, though I asked for a thing. My patients offered whatever they could. That's the rule. Some people gave beautiful blankets, expensive clothes, $50 bills. Others gave a bag of acorns. One woman brought a dozen white hens and 4 spotted pigs. I remember, because she had them tied up or strapped down, whatever, in the back seat of her Model A Ford, and for good reason, we couldn't keep those things locked up anywhere. The chickens flew into the trees and the pigs rooted under fences, but we had eggs and meat. We never went without. A lot has changed. For me, things happened gradually, passed unnoticed, until one day I was sitting and realized I had been sitting for some time. Where once there was this or that, now there was nothing. No clothes to fold, no lunches to get ready. Time opened up a space, and I found myself sitting in the middle of it. I saw the distance between me and those clothes and the lunches. I counted the days, then the weeks and months between patients. Of course, once the space was opened and I saw how I was sitting, I knew by the aches and pains in my body that things could not be otherwise. Trick, I suppose. The old poisoners are gone, except for Hatcher and maybe a couple others I haven't heard from lately. Old Miguel is alive, they say, and living with an 18-year-old white woman. I guess he's putting what's left of him in that. I don't know. The thing is, poison hasn't gone anywhere. It's everywhere, so people can't see. And what they can't see, they don't know. They don't believe. Maybe in time it will take new songs, new words to stop the poison. I don't know. Sometimes I think I'm done for. Funny thing, I took up cards. It gives me something to do since I can only weave baskets so long before my eyes give out. I play solitaire and it's fun. I mention this because it leads to what just happens, the end of this story. I was holding a card in my right hand, just the card I needed to finish the game, which was the Queen of Hearts. When I got stuck, my arm wouldn't move. I thought my arthritis or a stroke. The car dropped. Then I turned and took hold of my walker. I knew what was happening. I could feel it. It's just that it had been so long, at least a year, since the last time I felt this. Can't recall the details, except to say the next thing I knew, I was standing in front of the shed, and the little green thing with black glinting eyes came around the corner, and I was full of songs. The songs pounded the buildings and everything in sight, and I listened to the voice and found out about the work I was to do the next day. I was listening where I couldn't see the frog anymore. Just like in the beginning of things. And it turned out true. The next day, that boy came with his mother and father, the football player from Santa Rosa. I'm proud to say he's Indian and just as handsome as the papers make him to be, and strong, a large boy, who looked as frightened and small as a trapped finch when I opened the door and first set eyes on him. "Do you still doctor the sick?" his mother asked in Indian. She didn't speak my language, but a language close enough so I could understand. Besides, I knew what she wanted. I backed up, pulled my walker out of the way. "Come in," I said, back in her language. The boy had been sick for some time. The medical doctors figured a blow to the head from his football game, but they could find nothing from their tests. For 6 months, forgetful, he wandered here and there around from home. I sang and danced. I used my cocoon rattle, smoked angelica in my pipe, and held old uncle's basket until my hands were ready, until they moved to that young man's forehead and seized upon something that twisted and squirmed with all its might against me in the center of the boy's mind. Something that, when lifted out, could not be seen with the naked eye, but was heard by everyone as a woman singing. I held the voice cupped in my hands for just a moment. I knew it was Hatcher. I didn't know why, whether someone had hired her to harm the young man, whether someone was jealous or wanted him or what. I knew the song, and I knew the voice, even as it was that of a young woman, sweet and high. But something happened. I had a funny feeling. The song was touching me. It was a nice feeling, gentle, hitting my heart the way leaves touch down on a dry autumn earth. In that moment, I wanted to embrace the voice. I was full of gratitude. So much came into my eyes. Then I became, I wanted to hold that voice forever. Of course, I couldn't, so I turned ever so slowly and held it over the burning candle next to me and waited until it was silent. Thank you. Thank you. Well, there's time. I mean, I guess we're not supposed to do this, but I'll do it anyway. If you have questions or want to talk, I think we're supposed to go for an hour, and I think we have 10 minutes. So let's fill the hour and get yours. You came kind enough to come out in a cold, windy night, so we can break the rules a little. I say, I'll probably, Larry or someone will get mad later, maybe. I don't know. Does anybody want to ask any questions? You're well trained. You don't want to ask questions. Yes.
Talk about the relationship between the native magic and the metaphor of them having to go to the Indian Health Center and stuff, you know, to get her medicine.
Do you want me to talk about that? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Well, remember, the two aren't totally unrelated. I mean, certain medicines, white man medicine, if you want, are just as powerful and can help certain diseases like arthritis, some things that we don't have songs for, maybe, or something like that. That you don't have to always see the things as antithetical. As Auntie Mabel McKay once was being interviewed as a medicine woman, Indian medicine woman, and a student in the audience said, "Well, what do Indians do for poison oak?" And she said, "Calamine lotion." Right? So, you know, if the two go hand in hand, there are certain potions that are good, and she gets things at Indian Health. The point is to remember, and one of the things I wanted to convey in the story, that these medicine people and so forth are human too, with human desires, and they're negotiating that which is human. They're not these transcendent Dalai Lamas or whatever that are out there that rise above the facts of life and history.
So
Mm-hmm. Maybe some doctors could. I don't know. I don't know. But that was prophesied in our tribe in 1959. We had a basket, and our spiritual leader said that in some time in the future, excuse me, this basket would be dripping sweat. A great disease, a pestilence, would arrive on this land. And at that time, this basket will be working hard. It'll be dripping sweat off itself. The pitch in it would start melting. And it started melting about 15 years ago. Yeah. So there's connections. It's all one world, remember. Yes.
So then the basket is important, has an important function in the circle of mercy.
Oh, yes. Yes.
I'm unfamiliar with the culture in which the basket is oracular. Could you talk about that?
Oracular. Yeah, well, the baskets, we have baskets, and Pomo people are, of course, famous for the baskets. You see our baskets in museums. But many of these are, by our dreamers, are associated with healing and with prophecy, with dreaming and prophecy. They dream the designs and so forth. And so a lot of these are used to heal or to cure or to tell stories around, right? So they're living things. They're not just things under glass. Okay, for us, I don't know, you know, I don't want to talk about other Indians. I'm always told, don't talk about other Indians, they'll hoodoo you. Wove miniature baskets, and you had to look at the design through a magnifying glass. Right, they're that small. You've probably seen some of them in museums. The Pomo are known for those. But those, she weaves out she doesn't know what she's doing. She goes into dream, and the spirit tells her what design for each person. And she was the one that wove the basket about the AIDS prophecy. We didn't call it AIDS. But and when she gave it to Mrs. Parrish, the other dreamer, Mrs. Parrish, went into trance, and she said, this basket is speaking to me. It's saying someday, some year, a pestilence will arrive on this land. Also, they're gift baskets and naming baskets and all of that. What's so funny? Basket baskets? Yes. Yes. No, I grew up in town in Santa Rosa, which is about an hour or so from the reservation. But I always went there. I mean, every summer we'd go there and for ceremonies and stuff. But I didn't grow up chasing spirits in the woods or all of that. I was kind of a rough kid, more in the streets, you know, and I was around more drinking, although I was fortunate to be around a lot of the older women and a lot of the spiritual people, but I didn't pay much attention until I was older. Okay. Yes.
Are some
of these
people that
you
mentioned
so much? In the story? Yeah. Why? I write a lot about anger, and you want to talk about how I dissipated a lot of the anger in my own life by writing. All right, by exploring and writing it, because there is a lot of anger. I mean, the troubles that my father went through and a lot of the darkness, many of us Indian people and other people, for that matter, have inherited a history that in many ways is dark and that we don't understand, and so much of it becomes unconscious and passed from generation to generation in unconscious ways, the anger, the displacement, the low self-esteem, and all of that sort of stuff. And unfortunately, too many of us use our fists or use alcohol or drugs to try to deal with that dark, strike the darkness with our fists, or to be lost in it with alcohol or drugs. I choose, since I inherited in many ways a dark legacy, to fill that darkness with words, to light the darkness with stories. Okay, and it heals me, as I hope it will in turn heal other people, be a model of ways to heal. It's the only out I know. And also our prayer ceremonies and things at home. Those are helpful.
They help me explain things in a way where I can explain them here. Okay. I still have a couple more. Yes, way in the back. Yes. That's where my grandmother's from, yeah. No, the last fluent speaker of any coast, there were several coastal Miwok languages, but the last fluent speaker, Florence Ballard, died in 1978. The last person to speak it she spoke the Nicasius dialect from around Novato pretty well, passed away about 3 months ago, Mrs. Juanita Carrillo. Yeah, but there are no speakers left. But that doesn't mean, remember, it's a long history of how we were denied. Well, I'll tell you part of the story. Suppose we applied for federal recognition 3 times. In 1923, a federal agent was supposed to come out to see if we could get a land base in federal recognition. His car broke down and he never made it. He wrote back to Washington that we didn't need it, that we were fine, which we've just uncovered. Al Logan Slagle, our lawyer, has just uncovered this in the documents. So, and I was very sad to see that Mrs. Carrillo and many other people who wanted to know what happened didn't live to hear the story happen. But now, of course, we're going to court. And it's been an ugly history there in San Rafael. There was an old woman named Crawling Woman, and I'll finish with this story, which is a lot about why I want to unearth these stories. And they tell the story about this old woman, Crawling Woman, who was a grown woman in 1812 or so, when the first Spanish came in and established the missions in San Rafael. And she lived through that. And she lived through the Mexicans who came and had established a slave raiding system and raped and pillaged, and then the squatters who followed. And she was a Coast Miwok woman. She lived through 100 years, and she died in 1900 when she was about 110 or 115 years old. And they forgot, no one knew her real name. They think it was Maria, or one of the names she had was Maria something, but then everybody in the mission was called Maria, right? You're always baptized Maria Josefina, Maria, or, you know, whatever. And so anyway, she never told people much about her life, and at the end of her life, she became an imbecile, and she crawled, and that's why they called her Crawling Woman. In the last 5 years of her life, all she did was crawl around. She didn't know any of her grandchildren, her great-grandchildren, none of her children. She was like a child, and she just crawled around, and they had to watch her. She didn't know anything, and often the younger children were, while the parents went out and worked, had to babysit her, and they had what she would do, this Crawling Woman, is crawl out of the house, and she could go really fast, even at 105 or whatever she was, and she'd crawl up the road and crawl down to the coast, and the kids couldn't get her back in the house. She just wouldn't behave, and she'd crawl and hide behind trees. So they had an old Mexican army general's coat hanging in the closet, and what they'd do is they'd put on that coat and go out and find where she was. And she'd look, and she'd see the brass buttons of that army general's coat, and she'd screech and crawl back to the house and go under the bed. So at the end of her life, she never told her story, but think of that history that was there. That at the end of her life, she didn't know anything but those brass buttons and the fear associated with it. And that's the story we have to unpack. All of us, in many ways, are crawling women. And we must unpack that. Thank you very much.